Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Sports Pro Podcast. I am your host, Tom Bassam, and this week we are talking all about the Premier League. Last week there was a semi-serious, let's say, announcement or pre-announcement almost that the Premier League was about to change its increasingly controversial profit and sustainability rules, aptly named for really providing clubs with not very much profit and arguable levels of sustainability. That's a question of semantics rather than a question of business. What essentially it means is that from the 2025-2026 season, the Premier League will be scrapping its current PSR rules, implementing a similar system to what UEFA have been using to measure the performance and I guess also the compliance of its clubs, which is more of a squad cost rule. In essence, this is indexing how much clubs can spend on their playing squad against how much revenue they generate. All of this is supposed to provide football clubs with a bit more of a serious approach to business, where they're not overspending on those things in order to dramatically outperform their rivals on the pitch. But its effectiveness has been questioned both under the current rules and also under the rules that are coming in. I'm lucky enough to be joined for this episode by a absolute brain box when it comes to this. Kieran Maguire from the well-known Price of Football podcast. Kieran is a lecturer at the University of Liverpool and the go-to man really when you want to talk about football finance, especially in the UK. Now, I think it's probably best to hand over to my conversation with Kieran. Kieran, it's been a busy month for your inbox by the sounds of it. Lots of incoming emails regarding filings of accounts from the various Premier League teams, which we'll come to. But I thought we'd start at the top by talking about the new Premier League's squad cost rules.
Right. What was originally called financial fair play, but then people realised it wasn't particularly fair to an awful lot of clubs in the Premier League. They decided to rename it, effectively rebadge, as profitability and sustainability rules, which again, from my point of view, given that they effectively encourage clubs to make losses, was neither profitable nor sustainable. But under those rules, you were allowed to lose £105 million over a rolling three-year period, in effect. And if you spent money on what I think we can broadly describe as virtue areas, infrastructure, academy, women's team, community scheme, things like that, then those figures were excluded from calculations. So therefore, when Spurs built this quite staggering new stadium, none of those costs were included. And that's good because it encourages clubs to invest in better facilities for fans, better facilities for players, improves the overall quality of the game and so on. And that £105 million has not changed since the introduction, which was 2013 in effect, even though we've had substantial inflation in terms of football itself. So I calculated that if we'd sort of index linked those things at limit to football inflation, the ability to spend more money, that 105 would today be 216 million and we would have no points deduction. So that's caused a bit of a bad feeling from boardroom and terraces at Goodison and Forest, as you can understand. Those rules were starting to bite, as we've clearly seen this season, and they were broadly parallel with what we have operating in UEFA, except under UEFA rules, you were allowed to lose 30 million euro as opposed to 105 million pounds. So we have had scenarios where clubs such as Wolves, when Wolves were in Europe for a season, they broke UEFA's rules, but they were within the Premier League rules. And then UEFA decided to have a rethink. I think they are very much under pressure from the larger clubs, the clubs who were keen on Super League, via the vehicle of the ECA, the European Club Association, to switch to some form of broad wage cap. So that's what we now have operating in Europe. And under those rules, what you do is, first of all, you set your cap, and your cap is your revenue from your three main sources, TV rights, broadcasting, and match day, plus your player sale profits. And I think you effectively can take the best figure from either the last season or the average of the last two seasons or the average of the last three seasons. And that makes sense. It helps to smooth out some of the numbers on a year-by-year basis. So that becomes your target number. And what UEFA have then said is that this season you can spend 90% of that money on wages for players. So you have effectively your first team squad, I think your first team management team. Then you can have to add to that your agents' fees, because agents are the pantomime villains of football. So let's pretend that we're going to say that they're the bad people and this will help to keep agents' fees. No, it won't. And then finally, transfer fees or player recruitment costs. And that comes from two elements. First of all, amortization, this phrase which nobody had heard of 12 months ago. And then Todd Bowley decided he was going to get it trending on Twitter by signing players on 8-year contracts. So the way that it works, you sign a player for 50 million quid, 5-year deal, you say, well, that works out as a cost of 10 million a year. And then finally, any player write-downs. So if you've signed a player and either turns out to be a bit rubbish, so Chelsea, for example, in 2022, they wrote down player values by £72 million. I think it'd be rude to say who those players are, Lukaku, but or the player has a career-ending injury. With both Brighton fans, Enoch Mwepu was a really promising player and then had to retire early due to a medical condition. So the club has to write those players down under those conditions. So that's what you can spend, and that's going to be 90% this season, 80% next season, and then it will be 70% on these sort of broad player costs from 25, 26 onwards.
And that's UEFA competitions. And what we're moving towards in the Premier League is something similar to that?
That's right. I think the view taken in the Premier League and the noises that we've had come out of the most recent executive meeting, which took place this month, which I believe is going to be ratified. There's a two-day chief executive meeting scheduled for, I think, the second week in May, is they're just going to sort of work out what they consider to be appropriate. From what we can make out, for those Premier League clubs that are playing in Europe, they'll be given the ability to spend 70% on these areas. And for those clubs who are not in Europe, they can spend 85% on wages and so on, which could mean that you would be better off if you want to spend the maximum amount. If you're seventh in the Premier League, might be an idea to lose a match at the end of the season, because the Europa Conference probably means that it restricts your budget, because the Europa Conference is not particularly lucrative, but it does mean that you can only spend 70% instead of 85%.
Not particularly lucrative if you're a Chelsea or a Tottenham, but quite lucrative if you're a Brighton or even a Wolves, I'd suggest. Like, that's probably a revenue bumper between 5 and 15 million, something like that, for being in that competition when you factor in match days and factor in the TV rights reward money that you get back. I can see that argument for the big clubs, certainly, or the clubs that would consider themselves above the Europa Conference League. But there's definitely, they're still worth shooting for that competition if you're perhaps in the sort of the mid-tier.
As a fan, if I get the chance to go on a Europa Conference tour, which will be far zanier, won't it, than...
Oh, for sure. Well, certainly than Brighton's Europa League tour this year, where it's essentially a Champions League light, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. But when you actually talk to a few execs, they say you need a bigger squad if you're in European football, because you've got a guarantee of 8 matches now from next season. So that you need the squad which is going to be big enough to be able to deal with Sunday, Thursday, Sunday, Thursday. You're going to have additional injuries, which will probably impact upon your final league position in the Premier League itself. Each position will probably be worth £3.5 million from next season. So you factor in higher wages, higher transfer fees, because you've got to have a broader shoulders. And then that 15 million quid that you get from participation gets swallowed up. And that's before you take into consideration travel, accommodation, all of the compliance issues that you'd have to deal with in terms of UEFA. The reason why the Premier League has brought in the new rules, and I know that there are conspiracy theorists around who will say it's just there to help the big clubs, and it does help the big clubs, let's be honest, but then so did the old rules, is that it seems a bit daft to have one set of rules which applies to 7 or 8 clubs in the Premier League who are participating in Europe, and another set of rules for those clubs when they are dealing with things on a domestic basis. So it's just to sort of align things. Although there's further complications, because UEFA's rules apply to a calendar year, which is the 1st of January, 31st of December, and the Premier League's rules historically have been done on a seasonal basis, effectively to the 30th of June. So it's more work and therefore more money for the accountants. There are ways of gaming the system, and without wanting to sound too cynical with regards to this, my experience as somebody that used to teach a course called Creative Accounting is that a new set of rules just means a new set of loopholes to find.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen that, haven't we, with Chelsea and the current set of rules. But we can come on to Chelsea and potentially some other creative accountants a little bit later on. I guess one thing I'd kind of like to explore on this before we move on is, as you said, like, who do these changes really provide advantages to? We've talked about the fact that there's slightly different rules for Europe and clubs that are not playing in that competition that allows the clubs not playing in the competition to potentially spend a bit more on their squad costs. But is the idea of like tying this to overall revenue figures? As you said, these rules generally benefit the bigger clubs, but say a Man City, whose revenues are, they could be potentially as much as two or three times some of the other teams in the Premier League. Therefore, they can spend two or three times as much on their wages. And if you were to do some analysis on really what is the biggest indicator of performance in the Premier League, it's wage costs, right?
Yes. I mean, if we just simplify it to say Manchester City last season generated £700 million in revenue, approximately, that means that they can spend £490 million on wages and sort of, yeah, the net transfer cost. Newcastle United, who, yeah, under the new owners, I think we could describe them as ambitious stroke aspirational, their revenue was £250 million. So that means that they can spend £175 million on wages. So Manchester City have got a £300 million head start. That means that Manchester City can recruit the best players. That increases the chances of Manchester City qualifying for the Champions League, which means that they're going to have more income coming in than a club that's not qualifying for the Champions League. So it does reinforce the status quo. And Newcastle fans have, you know, finally realised that these rules are quite impactful on their club. Same you could argue at Villa, the same you could argue at Everton. You know, I think the issue with Everton's owner, Farhad Moshiri, was that he spent £750 million on the club. He just spent it on the wrong players.
Looking through, and I'm going to try and quote your own figures back at you a little bit. Am I right in thinking that Man City actually are quite underneath that headroom when it comes to the percentage of their revenue costs?
Yes, Manchester City would be in a pretty strong position. First of all, they do generate more revenue than any other club. And again, I know that there'll be snarky comments about the legitimacy of that revenue, especially the fact that, you know, 50% of Manchester City's revenue comes from commercial deals. Although if you take a look at the number of sponsors and commercial partners that Manchester City has on a global basis, it's quite staggering. But they are not yet the global brand that is their noisy neighbours or Liverpool or even Chelsea. It does take a bit of time, but you would be surprised. You know, I went to Croatia a few months ago and the most common shirt that I saw was Manchester City with Haaland 9 on the back of it. Yeah, and that took me back a bit. They're big in the States and some of the other markets in Asia where the legacy fan has a slightly different perspective. You know, I've lived in Manchester 4 years of my life. I've got a huge affection for Manchester City because my mates who are City fans have been down in League One and they kept going and so on. But yet Manchester City are in a strong position. And the other thing which Manchester City are very good at doing, which they don't really get credit for, is that they're very good at selling players. You know, Sterling's gone, Mahrez has gone. Okay, Cole Palmer has gone and looks a bargain for Chelsea, but it's still a £40 million profit as far as Manchester City is concerned. City also sold, you know, James Trafford to Burnley for £20 million pure profit. In 22-23, I think they sold three or four academy players to Southampton for a combined £40 million. And this tends to go under the radar. So because they are excellent in terms of player development, both in terms of senior players and academy players who they then sell, they effectively use them as commodities. And they're not the only club to do that. And that's not a criticism. It's the way that the system works. They are in a very strong position. And if they continue to dominate the Premier League, if they continue to be semi-finalists or better as far as the Champions League is concerned, then the money's going to keep flowing in.
No, absolutely. In terms of who else is doing quite well on that or is potentially set up to do quite well under these new regulations, are there any other clubs that look in a decent position?
I've got the spreadsheet here.
I was banking on this.
Spurs are in a really strong position because although Spurs lost £90 million last season, most of that was infrastructure costs. Spurs' wage bill, if you take a look at Spurs over the last 10 years, has consistently been below half of their revenue. So they've always had the capacity to spend. And I think that's one thing that you need to be aware of, because I think we sometimes fall into the trap of viewing limits as targets. And I have always had this, and this is not being me being misogynist in any way, shape or form. I have this argument with my wife when it comes to our credit card. Just because it's got a £20,000 limit doesn't mean you're going to need to go and spend £20,000 on it. You know, it's still debt. And she said, well, if I don't spend £20,000 on £1, surely I'm doing the right thing. No, spending zero is actually quite good. And it was also intriguing for me as somebody sort of with a vague financial background that when I was talking to the fans of many, many clubs under the old Premier League rules, their viewpoint is that if you're not losing £105 million over 3 years, then you're not ambitious. Well, hold on. You know, that £105 million is not coming out of your pocket. It's coming out of somebody else's. And from a business point of view, it's a really nuts thing to do. You know, the Premier League last season, if you think it was a non-COVID season, lost £1.2 billion from day-to-day operations of football clubs, which is ludicrous for a successful business.
It's something I've actually talked about on this podcast before is the idea that it's kind of normalized making losses for a business. And actually in the sports industry, like that's something that's almost completely unique to football. This idea that this is good. This is the way it should run.
Yes.
And like, really, it's not. What you want to do is make sure that of course you're improving all the time and you're able to invest in your playing squad. But it's, as you said, that £105 million loss, that shouldn't be something that's being shot for. That's bad business. And the way that's kind of borne out is the fact that these financial regulations are starting to bite. If we can go back to the point you made right at the start, is that £105 million barrier? Like, is that something that should have evolved? And the fact that clubs are bumping up against it now, is this the Premier League just trying to show we are financially responsible? We put in place these rules and we're doing something about it. Now the clubs are actually in breach of it.
And therefore we don't need an independent regulator to get involved in our industry.
Well, that's part two of that question, yes.
I think if we take a look at the two clubs that are specifically of their points deduction, in the case of Everton, it was a combination. None of it down to the fans. Yeah, as fans, you turn up in good faith. But I always say that if you take a look at how any business is run, its success or lack of success comes down to three elements. You've got resources, so financial resources, playing resources. You've got opportunities if you're in the Premier League. Yeah, because let's face it, if you're Rangers or Celtic, your opportunities are limited by the fact that you're in the SPFL. And the third issue comes down to the quality of senior level decision making. In the case of Everton, they've got resources. You know, Mashiri put in £750 million. They've got the opportunities because they're in the Premier League. They are what you would call a senior team in the Premier League. So both of those are positives. So why have they suffered so badly? Comes down to the boardroom.
No, but I don't think it's any surprise that that board has also been overhauled massively in the last couple of years. What are the very key performance indicators of on-pitch results and financial performance have both gone south? Like, that says to me that this isn't something that was being run particularly well.
It was a bit like having a lottery win and going to Harrods and just spending everything and then coming home and go, why did I buy that?
Yeah, I had an amazing analogy for this, actually. I think it was on the Athletic Football podcast, and it was like, if they described Chelsea's shopping spree as going to the supermarket and coming home with condiments. And I kind of feel that Everton are actually the prototype for going to do your big shop and coming home with a shopping bag full of ketchup. Yeah. Yeah. What was the other team that you were going to highlight? Is this Forest?
Yeah, Forest. But we've also seen Manchester United muttering that they've been unable to spend as much money as the media and social media would like them to. When you take a look at the accounts in detail, they have spent that money very significantly. And again, you know, this is not a football show, but you know, Manchester United have spent, I reckon, around about £1.4 billion on player recruitment since Sir Alex Ferguson resigned. How many of those signings have been a success? Bruno Fernandes, yeah, brilliant footballer, even though he's tantrums. And then you're going, well, when do they really get value for money? You know, Di Maria, Pogba. You go through that list of players on whom they have spent substantial sums, and Sancho, Anthony, Mason Mount. They've not exactly turned that into, yeah, that was a lot of money, but it was a really good buy. Whereas both Liverpool and Manchester City have spent smart as well as spending big. And Manchester United therefore have legacy issues in terms of a high wage bill, high amortization costs, high overheads. Yes, they are Manchester United, but it does mean that FFP has caught up with them. And again, that's partly due to the fact that there has been no index linking. Under these new rules, we're automatically index linking. If you put up the price of your tickets by 10%, you've got 10% more matchday money, which means you can increase your wage bill. So we're introducing index linking into the equation a decade after the rules were first created.
If we can, let's talk about the overall health of the Premier League, like how you see it. I mean, you said there that there was still large losses reported for the last non-COVID season. All of the accounts have now come in. What are the trends there that you're seeing?
You are correct when you said we now have the normalization of loss-making business. And that makes reporting it become the norm as well. You know, the average losses in the Championship, for example, $470,000 a week. And you go, well, that's just ludicrous. You got people such as, you know, the owners of Bristol City putting in £20 million a year. Millwall's accounts came out yesterday. You know, Millwall are a community asset club, like many clubs. You know, they're a part of the identity of the local area and so on. In the last 2 years, the owner put in £10 million in 2022 and £13 million in 2023. And notice, but this is Millwall. They're not moving the dial. They're not being seen as a potential entrant into the Premier League. And those losses are, people say the bubble's going to burst, but I'm not convinced that is necessarily the case, because we have other industries which are trophy assets. That's what we have now. So we've got a switch, I think, in terms of many owners treat the clubs as trophy assets. If you're into yachting, you're not going to make any money from professional, you know, running a yachting team. If you own a racehorse, and my brother-in-law's got about five or six, or shares in five or six, I say, you know, do you enjoy it? He says, I pretend I do. But the two best days of owning a racehorse are the day you buy it and the day that you sell it. The bits in between are just a very expensive hobby. What is unique, I think, in respect of the Premier League in particular, is that we have this clash of cultures between American owners who believe the ticket prices are far too low, and they've been waiting for an opportunity to increase ticket prices. And that's what we're starting to see happen in last season and next season. And, you know, fans who are opposed to that for a variety of reasons, cultural legacy, financial, economic, social, and so on. There was a really good article in The Athletic today from Adam Crafton about it's a case of when rather than if we're going to start to see the FA Cup final first, or and then the League Cup final, and then, oh, well, La Liga are playing matches in New York and they're charging an average of $200 a ticket. We need to have a round of Premier League matches in individual markets. And America will be one, Middle East will be another, potentially you could have for them in Tokyo and so on. And the reason why that will become acceptable, it's because, well, other people are doing it. And if we want to match them, if you want us to sign the best players, then we have to do that. And you will start to see that drip, even though, you know, myself as, you know, a 60-plus-year-old legacy fan will fight tooth and nail, you are feeling a bit like King Canute in trying to push back the waves on that. So I think we will see a change in revenue maximization becoming more and more important. And those people that have bought clubs and have lost money will start to reduce those losses.
I'm not sure I entirely agree about overseas games. I think you're right, maybe FA Cup final, but then the FA, they've got to decide whether or not they want to give up the revenue from the semis and the final, potentially. The League Cup, I can definitely see that going overseas. Like, it's a competition that needs a refresh. Round of Premier League games, I think you'd be really hard pressed to try and take those away from fans. But I think you could see it in La Liga. Fans there are so much more like enthralled to their clubs and be like, yes, the club is right. Germany, almost the opposite, but in the same way.
Yeah. No.
almost the opposite in that, like, no, you're not going to tell us what to do. And here, similarly, I think there's still that community asset thing of this is too important to us to do this. So I don't know. Maybe in 20, 30 years' time, you'll be right. And all the games will be played anywhere, and there won't be a UK league. It'll just be a amorphous super league of some kind anyway. But I don't know. I'd push back against that in the short term just because of actually...
Short term, I agree with you. Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're still, to our credit, is we still care enough to actually make that not happen. And that's me talking as a fan rather than someone hosting a sports business podcast. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting from your little appraisal of the accounts, revenues up 10%. But the one I really wanted to go into was football net debt. What does that mean? And should we care about it? Is this something that fans and people who like to know the lingo is worth digging into?
Well, I'm delighted that football net debt is now a metric which is used by UEFA. It is the amount of borrowings that a club has, either to banks or to the owners, plus the amount of money which is owed in terms of unpaid transfer fees. And this is something which has blown up over the course of the last decade, because what we are now seeing is that the clubs are buying players on credit. So in the case of Manchester United, when Sir Alex retired, and I always use this as a touch point, Manchester United owed 13 million quid to other clubs. Who cares? That figure is now 360. And you go, whoa. And then if you take a look at the Premier League as a whole, at the end of 2022, it was £1.8 billion in unpaid transfer fees. And the reason for this is that if you're signing, when Spurs signed James Maddison, for example, from Leicester, it was a £40 million deal. But what Spurs did was they paid £13 million as a down payment. They'll pay £13 million in July, August 2024 and £14 million as a final payment in 25. And that's to assist cash flow as far as those clubs are concerned. Well, that total has increased from £1.8 billion at the end of 2022 to £3 billion at the end of 2023. So football net debt, what we owe to the banks, what we owe to other clubs. We then say, well, hold on, you might have some cash in the bank. So therefore, we then subtract any physical cash balances that you have, and you would then subtract any money which is due to be received from player sales. But we owe £3 billion. We're due to receive £1 billion, and a big chunk of that is what Chelsea owe Brighton. And you say, well, why do the two figures not agree? It's because we're making so many signings from the international market. That total is quite high when you put all those figures together, and it would be far higher had it not been for the fact that all of the money that Chelsea owed to Roman Abramovich was effectively written off. They owed him £1.4 billion. So that number is heading north. Is it a cause for concern? It's not a cause for concern in my view. I'm far more relaxed about debt than many football writers, simply because for me, I've got a mortgage. It was cheap, so the rate, it's not as cheap as it used to be. We're seeing even the Wrexham owners, they've lent money to their club, and it's probably around about 9%, 10%. Southampton have borrowed at that. I've seen, I think, West Brom have borrowed at around about 14-15. So the amounts are not cheap anymore, but debt is all to do with cash flow. And people say, well, what about Spurs? They owe £900 million in debt. Well, it's not due to be repaid until 2039. So, what's going to happen in 2039? If you're the bank manager, you say, okay, Spurs, we've got two choices. You can either repay us. You've paid the interest every month. I'll just roll over the loan and you keep paying the interest for another 10 years. So it effectively becomes a cash flow issue from the club's point of view and a cash generation issue as far as the lender is concerned. It was the same with the Glazers and Manchester United. In the early years, when Manchester United were paying £100 million a year in interest on a business that was generating £200 million, it was a cause for concern. But now They've rescheduled the loans and Manchester United's revenues have gone up. So it's something to be aware of. It's something which people, I think, get very emotional about. And yeah, I say, well, hold on, you know, you've got an Amex card, you've got a credit card, you've got a mortgage, you've got student debt. You're still going for a pint every Friday night. So, you know, if you're able to deal with debt and you've not got 30, 40, 50, 60,000 people turning up once a fortnight to give you money, and they will buy any old tab that you put in front of them. Yeah, that's what we do in terms of football shows. They're ever-increasing prices. It's not as bad as I think some of the doom merchants are making out.
And I mean, I guess that's especially so if overall revenues that the clubs are able to bring in go up by 11% every year. I mean, that's not going to happen every single year. According to your Twitter feed, I'm looking at right now, 6.1 billion total revenues for the Premier League clubs, as said, up 11%. That's likely to go up again with the new TV deals where they've sold more games. So you're going to have more money coming in from that. There'll also be renewed overseas TV deals as well. So I don't think we're going to renew in the States and in the Nordic regions for a little while, but there are some extra bits and pieces to be squeezed out of the Premier League's overseas fan bases as well. So yeah, in terms of having the incomings to service that debt, it's not looking too bad.
For what we would refer to as a mature industry. You know, football's been around for a good century and a half now, hasn't it? The Premier League's revenues since it started in 1992-93 have increased by 2,800% over a period in which consumer prices have increased by 112%. Brilliant. What's not so brilliant is that wages have increased by 3,800%, which is why the clubs are making losses. But that's down to the clubs. Nobody's forcing them to sign off on these deals. You've got to look at the quality of the people signing off on the deals.
No, absolutely. That's probably partly back to the squad cost rules. That's where that's going to come in, right? It's like if you start, as you said, indexing the amount you can pay in wages and staff costs and all that kind of stuff to your overall revenues, you're not going to get situations like we had with Leicester where they're spending... was it 113% of their revenues on wages? That's crazy.
Yeah. And remember, that's from Premier League standards. You can understand it in the championship where you're making £8 million a year from a TV deal and you want to get promoted. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's understandable that your wages are higher than revenue. And we saw that with Millwall, who are a solid championship club. For that to be the case in Leicester, where they're making, what, £110 million from TV money and they're getting the commercial deals on the back of that and so on, I'm not here to depart judgment. It strikes you as spectacular mismanagement.
Yeah, but maybe spectacular mismanagement is a nice place to pivot into the last part of our conversation today. Obviously, you've looked at all the accounts of the teams next year. Who's in trouble? Who's going to be the next team deducted points or limiting their spending this summer? I think one that stood out to me was Aston Villa. Can you just unpack that a little bit?
The interesting thing in respect to Villa is they have very wealthy owners, which is a good thing. So therefore, the elephant, which is sometimes in the room in the form of administration, is unlikely to be an issue. They have had, over the course of the last 3 years, a Jack Grealish-shaped get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to financial fair play. Because you're assessed over a three-year period and Jack Grealish is an academy player, when you sell an academy player, the sale proceeds are pure profit. So they've managed to factor in £100 million of benefit. So I think we'll see with Villa, if they qualify for the Champions League and the new rules kick in for next season, I think they'll actually be in a relatively strong position. But they will have to be a little bit smarter. They'll have to use the exit door. And they have. Yeah, they think they sold somebody to Chelsea last summer, academy player and so on. I think where they might come slightly unstuck is there will be an expectation amongst the fan base that if they continue to play as well as they did against Arsenal and finish fourth, fans will expect the purse strings to be loosened. And that will be bit more compromised, a bit more complicated because their wage bill has shot up. Leicester City, whether they're in the Premier League or the EFL, I think they'll be starting the season with an asterisk potentially because it looks as if that wage spend that you referred to earlier is going to come back to haunt them, and it was quite high as well. I hate to say it, but Everton are not out of the woods yet. Everton's wage spend was 92% of revenue in 2023, which is why they've been second set of charges. We don't know how much things have improved since then. So, you know, they're going to be an issue. Forest will be slightly better off because Forest will be allowed to lose £83 million for the 3 years to the 30th of June 2024, as opposed to 61, because under the rules, you can only lose £13 million a season in your assessment period. You've been in the EFL, 35 in the Premier League. So they'll be slightly better off. They've shifted some players out of the door. Brennan Johnson, again, £40 million plus will help them. Chelsea is one which I am intrigued about. There's all of these stories coming out of Chelsea that the new players have come in on what they call low wages. And I think by low wages, that means somewhere in the region of 80 to 100 grand a week, replacing players who were perhaps on 50% more than that. That's the message which is being put out to journalists. Now, how accurate that message is, because that was the message that was coming out before Chelsea announced their results effectively 2 or 3 days ago, and Chelsea's wage bill was in excess of £400 million, which is the second highest in Premier League history, only behind that of Manchester City. And Manchester City had a higher wage bill last season because, well, they won the Premier League, they won the Champions League, they won the FA Cup, and you know, a few other sundry trophies thrown in for good measure. Chelsea finished, was it 12th or somewhere like that?
Yeah, that's why we've seen, well, one of the headlines in recent days has been Chelsea not just selling assets as in players, but selling assets as in things too, including their hotels to their owners, which is a trick that Championship clubs used to do with their stadiums, right?
That's right. Selling assets to related parties has been prohibited in the EFL since, I think it was 2020, 2021. Derby County did it, Sheffield Wednesday did it, Birmingham City did it, Reading did it. All of those clubs have subsequently had points deductions, by the way. So this was an act of desperation. Selling properties to your owners or a related vehicle. The Premier League has had the opportunity to outlaw this. It also appears to be outlawed under UEFA rules, depending on how you interpret those rules. So why the Premier League owners have decided to not go down that route is something we'll have to ask them, but we won't get a reply, I can guarantee it. It is something which is neither profitable or sustainable because you can only sell your house to yourself once. So it's a quick fix. The Chelsea figures do look intriguing. There's a £12 million settlement income in the accounts with no description as to what this means. There's £17.5 million where Chelsea, again, have charged another part of the Chelsea empire, £17.5 million. Yeah, whether that's for consultancy advice, I don't know. Whether it's for a tour of the grounds. And they said, well, okay, here you are. We want £17.5 million. It's all very, very strange. Reading the small print of the Chelsea account, which I wouldn't recommend anybody, they've got a life or a personality. What you do find is that Chelsea said, yeah, we've sold as a hotel and a car park to ourselves at a profit of £60 million. We think that's a legitimate price. We've submitted that to the Premier League. The Premier League have not yet signed off on it. And you go, oh, you know, what could that mean going forwards? And it's creative. It's depressing. I fell in love with football because of what's happened on the pitch. And it shouldn't surely be down to, we've now got a more creative accountant than you have. Creative midfielders, I like those. Creative accountants, it's a pretty sad indictment of where football has become as an industry, that these types of activities are, they're lauded and applauded by fans. You've only got to look at the reaction of the Chelsea Twitter fan base. And I'm going, you've just submitted record losses. You spent £740 million on players in 22-23, and you didn't even qualify for Europe. And yet they say, oh, no, we've outfoxed the Premier League. Well, if you didn't spend money on rubbish to begin with, you wouldn't have to go down this particular creative route.
You wouldn't have to. There are going to be a case study, I think, in a few years' time of something. What that thing is sort of may may well be, only be written in the next couple of years. It could either be an absolute disaster and we see a, dare I say, Leeds-esque spectacular fall from grace, or it will be something where maybe it'll be a bit more like the banking crisis where someone rides in, probably the wrong person, probably the people, and save what is a massive institution from fall that ultimately risked itself into. All right, Kieran, I'm aware I've kept you for a fairly decent chunk of time now. It's been absolutely fascinating as ever talking to you. Thank you so much. Always great to get your incredible financial analysis, actually, on the show. So, yeah, hopefully it won't be too long before we talk again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. We'll be right back.